This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Cairo. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton left here last night, bound for appointments in Tunisia. She's trying to manage the progress of the uprisings across the Arab world, uprisings that in some cases have turned bitter. Here in Egypt, Secretary Clinton met with protest leaders, except for those who refused. They said the U.S. didn't support their uprising strongly enough. She also met with Egypt's military rulers. The generals say they want to establish democracy after the departure of President Hosni Mubarak, a longtime ally of the United States. One challenge for Secretary Clinton will be building relations with whoever follows Mubarak. Has the United States, because of the events of the last couple of months, lost influence in Egypt?
I think that the United States has a different form of influence. We are now dealing with developing democracy. We have a lot of practice doing that around the world, both government officials as well as private citizens, civil activists, youth activists want the United States to be helpful, and we are going to look for every way we possibly can.
Although you have a country where Hosni Mubarak was an ally and willing in some cases, such as policy towards Israel, to do things that were clearly against Egyptian public opinion, if a democracy is formed here, whoever runs this country will have to be responsive to public opinion.
Well, Steve, first of all, the Camp David Accords set out certain obligations on the part of Egypt, and those obligations were immediately accepted by the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces after the changeover in government here. And we were very pleased to see those reaffirmed by the Supreme Council.
But if we get more specific, if you think about Egypt helping Israel to blockade Gaza, which Egypt has been doing, that's something that's very unpopular here by all accounts, and not necessarily something that would be envisioned in the Camp David Accords. Could not Egypt in some ways move away from, make some distance between the U.S. And Egypt in its policy toward Israel?
Well, that will be up to the new Egyptian government. But I think there's also an argument that Egypt's got security interests in not permitting the import and export of arms and possible ingress and egress of terrorists. So it's not only what Egypt will or won't do with respect to Israel, it's what Egypt will decide is in its interest to do, and that will be up to the Egyptian government to determine.
Do you expect that Egypt's interests will lead it to the same decisions that it made under Hosni Mubarak as far as foreign policy is concerned?
No, I think there will be different decisions, but I think that there is such an interest in keeping the peace in the region. Egypt's got a lot on its plate. It's going to have to politically reform, economically reform. It's got a big agenda ahead of it. I think the last thing it wants is to see any kind of, you know, problem between itself and its neighbors. And we certainly look to Egypt exerting leadership in the region and beyond, and doing so as a democratic nation, which we think will be a very good example.
Madam Secretary, as some people will know, you toured Tahrir Square while here in Cairo, the scene of the protests. 1 week ago in Tahrir Square, the army moved in against protesters who were occupying that square, arrested well over 100 people. A number of those people say they were tortured. I visited a man who said he was tortured and who had clearly been beaten severely. He had injuries all over his back. Did you speak in your meetings with Egyptian officials about the way that the new government is treating its citizens now?
Well, I certainly raised the concerns that you've just mentioned because they were raised with me. And I was assured that they would be looked into, which I expect will be done. One of the challenges for this new Egyptian government is to create a police force and have a well-trained police force that respects the human rights of its citizens. And they are very committed to that. As you know, they dissolved the state security apparatus, and I had a lengthy discussion about what it will take to try to create a new security system that will be respectful.
How are they going to do that?
They're going to start. They are very determined to do it, but it's a big task. They do have problems. As you know, there were a lot of criminals who broke out of prisons that unfortunately have not yet been apprehended, and there are signs of lawlessness. They're trying to move as quickly as possible to turn over law and order to a police force. That is not something the Army has told me that they have any intention of continuing. So there are some questions and some allegations that deserve and should be investigated, and I was told they would be.
We have also been talking here in Cairo with correspondents coming out of Libya, where the rebel position at the moment appears to be collapsing. The view seems to be that it is likely too late for a no-fly zone imposed from the outside to make very much difference. Is it too late?
I don't think so. I don't want to put a time frame on what is likely to happen in Libya. I'm well aware that Gaddafi is moving against the rebel stronghold in Benghazi. I have received different estimates as to how long it will take him to do what he intends to do to try to crush the rebellion. But I think it's important to note that there is intensive negotiation going on in New York as we speak to try to obtain authorization from the Security Council that will provide a series of potential actions, including a no-fly zone that could be taken. And I think that is the appropriate venue. There should not have been unilateral action by any country.
I invited questions from our listeners before this interview, and one question came in from a man named Jim Voorhees in Nashville, Tennessee, who asked about uprisings through the Arab world, such as Libya, where there has been great resistance or repression by the government. And he asks, how long will we fail to help?
Well, Steve, that is not a question that should be only directed to the United States, with all due respect to your listener. I think that President Obama has been absolutely right in being clear in saying that Gaddafi has lost the legitimacy to govern. But as you know very well, there is a vigorous debate by people of good faith as to whether any particular action is called for or would be effective. But there is very little debate that the Security Council, in its resolution 1970, did not authorize any no-fly zone, any delivery of arms, or any other kind of assistance other than humanitarian assistance. Now we are in a different environment where enough countries have watched what was happening. The Arab League has taken its stand, and now countries that said flat out they were opposed, they would veto, they would never support, are reconsidering.
Meaning that you don't have that option. You cannot act with an international consensus because it doesn't exist. That's what you're saying.
But we are working to achieve that international consensus. But
by
I think
the time you do, it's going to be too late, is it?
Well, you know, sometimes we have a lot. I wake up every day and I look at violence around the world. I look at women being murdered who marched on International Women's Day in Cote d'Ivoire. I look at, you know, women and men being murdered in Eastern Congo. I see a lot of violence by bad guys all over the world. And the United States has for decades tried to enforce the peace, tried to stand against people who were abusing their own people to a terrible degree. But, you know, we haven't been able to do everything that everyone would want us to do. But one thing that we are clear about is unilateral action would have unintended consequences that we cannot undertake. If there is international decision in the Security Council, then the United States will join with the international community.
Secretary Clinton, thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News.